Hi, and welcome to The Potential State. My name is Dr. Sal Romanelli, and today I'm in a conversation with Dr. Micha Belzer, who's a couple and family therapist in Jerusalem, and he's teaching a course on the family life cycle, and we're having an honest conversation about the lost years of couples. The lost years are kind of 5 to 7 years after the marriage. You have the two kids, mortgage, you're both in your professional track, and there's kind of this kind of relaxing or this kind of lull in the dynamic of the marriage. So this conversation is geared at a couple therapists, but it's actually really relevant for many couples. By the way, I'm in that stage of my life and of my marriage. And in this conversation, we describe a little bit of what's happening, the uncomfortable truths of that kind of cohort of that age, kind of those that decade, actually, the dangers, the challenges. And there's plenty of tips where I'm going to share how I work with these couples, what can they do to stay hungry, stay foolish, stay playful, stay within the crucible so they can grow and keep evolving even in those lost years. So I hope you find this meaningful. I found it really meaningful, and enjoy.
You are listening to The Potential State Podcast with Dr. Asael Romanelli.
So our subject is a family life cycle. We thought, what can we speak about that would be interesting? And we chose the years of marriage that we called them the hidden years.
Oh, the lost years, lost. The silent years, the years where it's just kind of, you know, after you have the honeymoon period and then you have the exciting having kids. And then that you know, the 7 year dip. You've got the two kids, got the mortgage, you got the dog. Both of you are kind of based in your professions, and you basically are starting the long marathon where your parents are aging on one side and your kids are growing up in the other side, and you're kind of in the middle hitting midlife crisis. We're talking about mid-30s, early 40s. And maybe I'll just say a word about my approach. Micha, you've mentioned in the beginning, and I think I would say today, if I had to define my approach, which is obviously, you know, it's very integrative, but I'd say I'm a symbolic experiential therapist, which goes back to Satir and Whitaker, which I'm sure you guys have learned, where everything that happens in the clinic is also real, but also symbolic. So within that experiential stream, like you said, bone therapy, and especially Schnarch, David Schnarch, who kind of developed the crucible paradigm, and every time Megan really brought it to Israel. And I integrated with my own backgrounds, my background in improv, and also a lot of Terry Real's work, relational therapy. So that's kind of where I'm coming from as we're talking about this topic. And I'll just say, I find that if I had to kind of think about my clinic, so I work privately. I work one day in Jerusalem, the rest of the time on Kfar Saba and Zoom, and I work, since the COVID, about 30% of my clients are online now. I'd say out of my couple family work caseload, I would say about half are that age group, which is actually a lot. And kind of, Micha, do you want to direct me or should I just start talking about it? So I think what we basically see at that age group, that kind of slice of the life cycle is really when the couple settles into a routine, into the comfort, or what we call homeostasis in systemic therapy, and everyone's comfortably numb, shall I say. And then what happens is as the kids are getting older and the parents are aging, once the couple is kind of in a comfortable place, what happens is that I feel like oftentimes they go into like parallel kind of lives. They get comfortable, each one's entrenched in their own system, in their own pattern, in their own dynamic, in their workplace. They divide up the roles. Who's going to be in charge of what? Who's strong in what area? Schnarch calls it high desire and low desire. I call it the 95-70 paradigm, which basically means every couple kind of divides it up the different categories. Who's the 95 and who's only the 70?
95 and what?
So this comes out, I'll be referencing a lot of concepts, and maybe we'll put in the description links to the actual videos. But this is a concept I've discovered on my own work, on my own marriage, because a lot of what I do in my videos is I talk about my own marriage and I bring in my wife to talk about these issues, because I believe, once wow. again, all therapists are hypocrites and I'm trying to minimize my hypocrisy. This comes out of my work with Galit, my wife, where I realized that for many years I was harboring this sense of superiority to her. And when she said, talk to me in numbers, I said, well, it's a 95-70 dynamic. And since then, we've kind of coined that phrase. And when I work with couples, I realize that in every department, unconsciously, couples divide up who's better. Who's the better lover? Who's the better parent? Who's the better provider? And what happened is it's a comfortable, unconscious decision. So the typical, I'm just going to use a stereotypical heterosexual relationship. The man is working. He's the 95 financially. The wife is more at home. So she's the 95 in parenting. Okay. And that's how they go on. That's how they're actually, they can live like that for many, many years. I'll say one more thing. Esther Perel, who we all know and love, obviously. So she talks about, we will all be married more than once. The question is, will we be with the same partner? So I've found that in recent years, that's kind of what I do. I help couples remarry. I've stopped measuring the success of marriage of how many years a couple's together. I measure by how many marriages have they had, how many dynamics they've had, how many homeostatuses have they had. So from the second, third date, these couples kind of have this homeostatus where they divide up. Okay, so you're in charge of the money, I'm in charge of parenting. You want to have, you're the more passionate one, I'm the more intellectual one. And vice versa. And that's how they run for many, many years. And what usually happens in the clinic is, when will they come to us? Right? That age group, that slice of that dynamic, when do they usually come? When something happens. Okay?
So I understand that you're saying that, first of all, I love what you're saying about your own work on your own self and marriage, which is a very strong concept of Bowen's, that he said you can bring someone to be differentiated as much as you work on yourself, your own differentiation, and being honest and vulnerable about it and bringing it up and working on it and seeing that as part of your work and working together even with your wife, and that sounds amazing. And what I understand from you is that you're saying that in these years, something dies. Like, just like you said, you need to like marry again. And you see that as a goal, if I understand you right, that, you went in parallel ways or all kinds of things became rigid. And it's like a place to start assessing from the beginning and choosing each other from a new place.
So I would say this, my job as a couples therapist, I believe, is to block exits and raise the temperature. Most couples are not looking for a second marriage because they don't know it's possible, because most of us grew up with parents that had one marriage for 40 years or 50 years, or they divorced. But we all know people that have divorced and married basically having the same dynamic again and again and again. So a lot of these couples will not come to me, but they usually come when something happens. When either life slaps them in the face, whether it's cancer, one of their parents dying, COVID, going bankrupt, an affair, okay, which is the classical one, or when something, they just hit rock bottom and they're like, I want something different for my life. So it can be an external slap on the face, or it could be hitting rock bottom internally. That's when I at least meet these couples. I rarely will have a couple that are like, oh, we're just in parallel lives. No, because usually they're just busy. Me and my wife, we're in that cohort, right? We have a 9-year-old, we have a 6-year-old, we have a mortgage, we're moving an apartment in Kfar Saba. My parents, that's life, right? And for most couples, they just kind of plow through those years until something happens. I want to combine this.
Something happens. Sorry. I'm just to make it exactly.
Emphasizing, yeah.
What I understand you're saying is that something does happen in these years. It's very significant. That's what we want to pinpoint. But you're saying that won't bring people to therapy. They'll continue their lives regularly. What brings them is when they get a slap in the face, something really happens, and then the problems raise up. But the problems were there before.
And this Gottman says, 70% of all your problems are unsolvable, regardless of who you marry. We all have problems. There is no perfect family. We're all flawed, okay? The question is, how are you flawed? Doesn't matter if you're married Moshe or Chaim, something's going to happen. So I wouldn't say it's problems. It's these 95-70s. I call this the original contract. The contract is signed on the third date unconsciously, and you run with it for 40 years. The thing is that we won't meet these people unless there's a problem. And then, because before there's a problem, they're just used to that because that's what they see. And by the way, on a societal level, that becomes the norm. I call this the single married mom, right? There's the mom, the wife is married, but she's basically running the kids alone because the father's all day at work. In Hebrew, we call this the Abba Pagum. There's a whole Facebook group with 500,000 men, and it's called Faulty Father.
where they joke about how irresponsible they are, right? And the equivalent group of the women is called the righteous, Hatzodeket, where they're like, oh, we're so right. And my husband, you know, he's never home. He doesn't talk to me. He's always on the screens. It's almost become like this running joke in Israel and also in the States. And I feel like that's one of the things I'm trying to fight against. I'm trying to help kind of do a societal revolution, because unfortunately that has become the norm. And we can definitely go into the men's covert depression, which is their midlife crisis, which happens at this age. And women usually kind of reinventing themselves, or once they kind of close the child rearing days or bearing days, they're like, okay, and now what? And maybe later we'll give some examples from some couples I'm working that I'm meeting them exactly that phase for two different reasons. And I want to kind of compare two different couples I'm working with coming from two different reasons, actually. So you're right, Micha, like they're going to come to us when something happens to them, or when one of them, usually it's going to be the wife, who wants more from life, from her husband, from herself. And usually we'll see that once the youngest kid hits three, once the diapers and the breastfeeding is kind of over, and then she suddenly has some time and she's like, wait, who am I married to? What's the story? What do I want? And this goes, and I have clients from the Haredi, from the Chiloni, from the secular, from the modern, like I'm seeing this as a cross-cultural kind of phenomenon.
Why would you say it's the wife?
Because usually what happens, and this, we could do a different talk just about men's covert depression. Most men, I'm feeling, and this goes back to Terry Real's work about men are underdiagnosed with covert depression, which basically manifests not as crying or sleeping or that. It manifests as numbness, emotional numbness. And for many men, the bar is so low, and all they think about is, as long as my wife is not bitter, or at least not bitter at me, I am happy. Mm. They don't need much. The amount of times I hear in the clinic, I don't need much. Yeah, you do need much, but you don't know how to say it because you've never seen it. But then they keep getting slammed, right? Because in today's modern world, the man needs to also make the money, but also be attentive to the kids, and also be a tender lover, and holding, facilitating feelings. So we're kind of an interesting intersection where not only women are faced with an impossible paradigm of be the best mom and be a professional. For men, we're seeing the opposite challenge, but it's the same. Keep providing, keep being sexy and manly, but also be very sensitive and sweet and be a parent and be present. And we're actually at a very interesting phase where the traditional roles are being challenged on both genders. But you see, the plight of the men is less heard. Their pain is less heard because usually they're already labeled as emotionally handicapped, numb, cold, cynical.
Autistic spectrum.
Yeah, my husband. Yeah, I call this the intimacy queen and the emotionally handicapped partner. And you can, I will reference some videos where I have like these videos where I talk about that, these specific phenomena that I've been seeing in the clinic in the past decade. So that's why I'll usually see the woman, unless, once again, fair disease, death of a parent, major illness of a child, which can wake up either one of the partners.
You're talking about one phenomena is what happens to the husband, where he becomes, some kind of an element of depression, something that has to do with he would appreciate if things are not too bad. He's okay with it because he doesn't know anything else. And you're saying there's something about midlife crisis that has something to do with some kind of cheshbon nefesh. You know, where am I? What did I achieve till today?
Who cares?
Did I achieve my dreams or not? And some kind of acceptance in the end of the day for who I am. But that is a process. And you're saying that's the man's side. And you mentioned the women's side that sometimes in this stage have more time and than they had before. And they recreate themselves and they are looking on their side and seeing this guy. And what are we doing together? And they want to reassess. Right. And those are things that happen there. But they still have small children. I mean, they're not like babies, but we're talking about a stage where children are between, you said, 3 and let's say 10 plus.
Yeah, right? Exactly. 10 to 12, right. Or the eldest is already 18, but the youngest is 3. Like, you're not 100% looking at your partner. You're still one eye looking at the kid, one eye looking at your partner, one eye looking at your career. And your parents are aging. Like, there's a lot of things in the air. Mortgage, like, that's what's happening. Your body's changing, aging. I'll say also that, you know, I've noticed since I've had, like, my midlife crisis hit me right after I finished my doctorate at 40. And I've noticed that that's A, I noticed that it's real because I felt it on my body. And since then, I've been working a lot with men and noticing it. And I've noticed for women, it comes a little bit early, 36, 37, depending again on the age of the kids, where they have like that similar like disillusionment. Where am I going? What's the point? Who cares? That kind of thing. And I think for that specific population, it's also interesting because divorce is usually not an option. They're not looking, like rarely will you see someone saying, well, I give up everything, you know. It's usually what we'll see, if I had to summarize and make it more extreme, what you said, men just want quiet, women want more from their men. And this is a generalization. Obviously, I have examples for both ways, but I just wanted to give that as an example. So then oftentimes, it's interesting to work with these couples because, as Schnars says, if divorce is not an option, you won't be able to do a second order change. You won't be able to do a deep change because one of the risks of doing a deep change, a second order change is, in systemic therapy, we call it, is the option of divorce. So for a lot of couples, especially from the religious and Haredi community where divorce is not an option, it becomes more challenging work and really assessing with a couple, how deep do you want to go? You know, in systemic therapy, there's a first order change, which is a behavioral change. Okay, date night, you know, set up a time to have sex or stuff like that, communication skills. And there's a second order change, which is a deep conceptual shift where I quit my role, I quit my 9-to-5, I'm renegotiating the whole relationship. And for some couples, they're not looking for a second order change, or usually the husband will be looking for a first order change and the wife will be looking for a second order change. And how do you manage that gap, that difference? Yeah. And for a lot of therapists, especially early therapy, beginner therapists, they don't know what the difference is. So they kind of dive into first order changes, but they're like, why is this not changing the dynamic?
And then they'll say in therapy that they did everything.
Right. I've tried everything. I've come to therapy, you know. I'll get clients that they've been to the three couple of therapists. So they got all their communication skills. They do imago, but they still hate each other's guts. So I'll say, I hear that you don't like, so I'm repeating all the insults you've told me. Like, has that really changed? Have I stopped being the emotionally handicapped? No. And that's where, you know, the differentiation paradigm, which is different than the attachment paradigm, works a bit differently.
Can you say a little bit about that? What would be your approach? What would you do? What would be the concepts that you'd try
So here I'll outline the potential state model. This is the model that I've developed together with my wife that kind of integrates improv, therapy, and education, which is basically my triangle. So it starts with play. The ability to be playful, and play is the lubricant of life. That's what I call it. And you need that in everything. So also as a therapist, I'll spritz a lot of play, a lot of lubrication in my session as I'm doing with you, like a little bit of jokes, a little bit of flirtiness, a little bit of like crude language to keep it playful, a lot of transparency, not to take myself too seriously, not to take the client too seriously, not to take life too seriously, because you have to have play in order to grow. And we could just do a whole talk about play. Then the first pillar would be to own your shadow, to own all those negative aspects of yourself that usually project, minimize, repress, or deny. If I had to make a generalization, for men, it's usually their vulnerability, not their aggression. And for women, it'll be their aggression, anger, even hostility. So they don't own that, and then they project it on the other, and that locks them in this dynamic, which never helps. So I work a lot with, the first thing I'll do is I'll block their exits, raise the temperature, and I'll always help these people confront their shadow. Yeah, Jung talked about shadow, which is the kind of all the garbage bag of our psychology. But in the shadow is my superpower. Shadows are not bad. Okay,
I like what you're saying. Let me take it. You know, I like to like hold it, hold me tight. Let's hold the stuff you're saying. I like what you're saying about this combination between something very serious that has to do with the ability to own my shadow, and this playfulness that you're trying to bring in. You know, lots of times you see these couple therapists or even sexual therapists that are so, you know, serious. And, you know, how can you talk about something so that needs such playfulness and such looseness in such a strict and rigid way? So I love this. I think it's like you have to be very creative to be able to like hold these two sides where you talk about something so serious in their life, you know, to be willing to be vulnerable and to touch my shadows. And from the other side, to be playful and to be able to like feel okay with myself and with my body and with my spouse. And you as a therapist to hold these two sides sound to me amazing. I would wonder how you do that. I mean, if you have, that's one thing.
Let me just jump on that for a second.
Yes,
okay,
yeah,
so
that's important.
So So me and my wife, we have a whole webinar where we teach couples to be more playful, because everyone thinks they're playful, but not necessarily. It's an art form. You can learn. You can. The good news is everyone can become more playful, but you need to practice it. And especially therapists. I mean, if I go back to what you said about Bowen, is I like to say we're our own glass ceiling. We're our own weakest links as therapists. I am my own glass ceiling, which is my level of differentiation. But this also applies to how playful I am. If I'm not a playful person, I'm not going to be able to create a potential state, a potential space, a transitional space of growth. So the first, and I want to say, like, if you own your shadow without play, and I, the reason I use the metaphor of lubricant, I purposely use a sexual metaphor, because I feel like I want to go to that shadow. Like, having intercourse without lubrication is sometimes hurtful, and it's too rough and it's too aggressive. But then I also say lubrication without the meaty part, without owning your shadow, is not deep. It's not, you need both. Just to be playful and silly is not enough. Do you understand? And I feel like a lot of times therapists will either go the very playful or silly and light, or they'll go super analytical. You need both, because one enables the other.
It a little bit reminds me of what you're saying now. What that, I forgot who said it, you know, about intimacy, that's intimacy. You know, Snarsh. The ability to bring yourself and to really, like Snarsh talks about, making love with open eyes, you know, to like really
exactly
be able to also bring myself fully and also see the other, right?
Yes,
fully.
Yes,
and that's like very. That's what I hear you saying. So how do you do that and still stay playful?
So I mean, this connects to the PhD of like, I was wondering why wasn't that when I was in the public sector, why wasn't that burning out like the other therapists? And I realized maybe it's my improv background. And then what I did with my doctorate is I basically taught improv. I taught a course in Hebrew University for 3 years, and I measured its effect on students. Today, I call this training the ninja therapist training. And there's a training I've developed where I help therapists maintain that playful spirit. And play is not just always happy. Play can also be playful is also very vulnerable. It's about owning your shadow. If I make a mistake, if there's a rupture, Micha, I confused your name. I called you David instead of Micha. How can I own that, own my shadow, and stay in the heat? Or in Snarsh's metaphor, stay in the crucible. Because therapy, just like intimate relationships, is a crucible. And my job is to block exits and raise temperature and have the crucible hot. But I'm also part of that crucible because, once again, it's experiential symbolic. So I'm in there. I'm part of that dynamic. It's a three-person psychology, not a one-person or a two-person. Because I'm also
mentioned a few times this strategy of or way of work where you block escape doors and you increase the temperature. Can you explain that metaphor a little more?
Yeah. So again, we'll put some videos there. But the basic idea is like this. Most of us we have so many exits. Let's go back to these couples. There's so many exits, work, friends, TV, computers, porn, whatever it is, right? So these couples don't meet. So what I really believe is the way to help people grow is to block their exits, not to let them run away or smoke screen. Okay. So physically, I mean, not physically blocking them, but in the room or even on Zoom, I will say, no, don't go over there, or talk to me in numbers. Bring this down. How important is this to you from 1 to 10? And you can't say 5. I'm purposely blocking them, or like he's going on this long lecture. I stop in the middle of a sentence and say, okay, what are you basically saying? Do you want to have sex with your wife, or don't you want to have sex with your wife? Right? And that's like an example where I'm blocking exits, I'm raising the temperature, and I'm not letting my partner kind of squeal away from it. And because the problem is these couples are basically smokescreening each other for years, or even gaslighting, which is even worse, right?
And then they use therapy to do the same.
Right. And then they smokescreen the therapist. And because we're nice, we're and the client, you know, you're letting the client lead. You can spend years in therapy and not actually talk about anything. And basically, I'm reminding all of us, therapy is an exercise in relationships, in intimacy, right? So they're going to do to me what they do to each other. That's why I love the school of experiential symbolic system, because what they're doing to me, they're actually doing to Asael, but it's also symbolic. And then what I try to do in vivo is try to react to them in a different way while their partner is eating popcorn, watching me react to their partner in a different way, and they're learning how to relate differently. And it's easy for me to relate to them because I'm not married to them. So I can love them more openly. I can hate them more aggressively. I can call them on their shadow more openly because they are not part of my system.
Wow.
And that's why I believe in couples therapy, because the problem is with individual therapy. By the way, this age group, a lot of times they'll go to separate therapists. usually the wife will go to a separate therapist. And then what we have a clinical affair, I call it, where the therapist becomes the amazing savior, the lover, right? The clinical lover. And the husband stays like the numb, you know. Yeah, he's just the bum. But my therapist, oh, he's amazing. He's amazing. I say, laughs with me, we cry, and we laugh, and he understands in ways. It doesn't help their marriage. It just you know, creates a bigger rift.
So you'll try to bring them together into the room to meet each other and not separate it.
Yeah, it's a two for one, I say. Why? A, you get to confront yourself. B, you get to see if you have another marriage with this partner. Because oftentimes, you don't have another marriage with this partner. And then you need to make a decision whether you want the same marriage for the next 20 years or you want a different marriage. But then you might have to risk being with a different person.
But you say what Snarsh said, that you need to risk. You have to have this ability to say, I'm willing to separate.
Even. Yeah, that has to be. I don't encourage divorce, but I don't feel like my job is not measured by whether the couple stays together or not. My goal is that they remarry, hopefully each other.
Yeah.
That's my goal.
I have a question that has to do with the life cycle, this stage in life. You know, because you're talking about something that requires so much work, inner work, you know, and the willingness to maybe become playful is something very hard by itself. And the willingness to face my shadow is also needs so much energy. And we're talking about a stage of life that you yourself said that, you know, you have so many different things that are, you still have the children that are need you, not as much as babies, but they sure need you, your parents, yourself, your career, and midlife crisis and everything together. Where do you have the capacity and the room to do this work that you're talking about? How do you even convince the couple to be willing to do what it takes?
Well, here's where it gets a bit easier, because once again, why did they come to me? Because something happened. So usually I don't have to. So here's another thing I want to say. Another mistake a lot of therapists do is they assume whoever sits across from them is a client. First, you have to suss out who's a client and who's not, who's a visitor or who's just a complainant.
So you, one some, of them.
Yeah. You're either a visitor, a complainant, or a client. Most people start off probably as complainants, but some of them are visitors, and then don't waste your time on them. You cannot want this more than them. The second you want it more than them, it's doomed. But that's a different talk. Yeah. So because they come to me because something happened, whether it's an affair or one of the partners is threatening to leave. So what I'll do is I'll just basically show them, because I can't want this more than them, and I'm trying to kind of soften my savior complex. I'm saying, okay, this is how it's going to unfold if you don't do anything. If you stay the emotionally handicapped, she's going to have either a clinical affair or a real affair or leave you. And just own that. I mean, again, I didn't finish the model, but the first step is just owning your shadow. But then there's two other ones, and I'll just add them here just for the flow. So play, right? Owning your shadow. After that, let it land. Learn the ability to let what your partner's saying in. Don't get defensive. Let that land into your body, because your body is smarter than your mind. Your body's always in the present, etc. That's a different talk. And then the third one is say the thing. I help couples become more direct, blunt, one-dimensional, and clear with their partner. Whether it's good, you're amazing, I love you, or it's really negative. It's like, I hate that behavior, or you really humiliated me in front of my parents. But it has to go in this order. First, you got to own your shadow. Then you got to let it land, and only then you can say the thing. So the way I work with couples is I really follow that model, and I help them block, let what she's saying in, or let what I'm saying in. And then I want to hear you bluntly, directly, one-dimensional, clear, not complicated, not ambivalence, like where are you for today? And that requires the tax you have to pay for working in this style is be willing to have a lot of ruptures, a lot of ruptures. My therapy room is filled with, I'm also in the crucible. And I get slammed. I mean, I finish the day bleeding because I get jabbed by my clients all day because I'm jabbing them because it's a face-to-face. Yeah. Because I'm wrestling with them, because this concept of Ezer Keneg Do, which I've never found a good translation in English, but I think everyone here knows it. Like, most of us don't have that. Most of us don't have this in our life. Most of our therapists are usually not Ezer Keneg Do. And it's my job. So I'm going to be an Ezer Keneg Dam. And a lot of times I have to reframe what they're experiencing, whether either insulted or hurt by me. I'm saying, I'm not trying to attack you, but what you're feeling right now is Ezer Keneg Do, and that's how it feels. And I want you to rewire your brain. This should be your standard. what you're feeling now with me as the therapist and look at the partner, this is what your wife has not had for the last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. You guys are out of shape. That's when that's the language. You guys are out of shape.
So if I understand your answer, you're saying, first of all, they have a motivation that has to do with something that happened. And that brings them in, and they're sometimes willing because they don't have any choice. Because if it's not, it's to live or die. You know, something like happened, it's very...
Or they'll leave us, or my wife will leave me.
Yeah. So then they're willing to like maybe do what it takes. But still, I wonder, even though after you also said another two things that are part of the... that are very hard to own. You know, you talked about owning my shadow. That by itself, everybody likes to do avinu chatanu on the other person's chest, you know? Like to say that my partner is all kinds of things. But yeah. Who likes to say that about himself?
Exactly.
And you're like bringing them to such intense and it takes so much energy. How do you convince them? That's what I'm trying to understand. To be willing to do the work. And I understand if it's they're not always that motivated to do everything right. It takes. So how
they're
do
they're rarely motivated.
Right.
So the two ways I do it, A, I don't try to convince. A, I model it. First of all,
okay, that's
I model it by being blunt and transparent. Important. That's a super important point because I am my own glass ceiling. So at first, I model it by the way I talk about myself, by the way I talk about my own relationship, by my own struggles. By my immediacy skills, saying the here and now here.
Which is not so, mekubal, you know.
That's not so accepted. I know.
But in couple therapy, it is different than individual.
Yeah. I mean, I also realize that, you know, we're going back to all therapists are hypocrites, right? How can I tell them be authentic and real and vulnerable when I'm not? Like, as a young social worker, I started doing family therapy when I was single with no kids. So obviously, I was a hypocrite, right? But I think through the years, obviously, because I had no kids and I'm talking to people that have 10 kids, like who am I to tell them? I mean, a little bit of humble pie here, like a little bit of humble pie. But I really think that it's not really about telling them it doesn't have to go like when I supervise therapists, not everyone's, you know, comfortable talking about their own marriage, but at least it's about comfortable about speaking. And this is called Clara Hill calls this immediacy skills, saying the here and now of the session. For instance, I see you were a little bit hurt by what I said there before. Like you're saying that you're sad, but it's not landing for me as sadness so much. Like to have the courage to call people out, to say the thing in vivo, in the session, but play is what's going to help me kind of repair that rupture. Because I'm playful, if I say something to you, Micha, and I'm wrong, I'll create an atmosphere where you can say, Micha, Asael, what are you talking about? You're crazy, right? Like it's not going to be, it's not going to be an error and mistake, you know, like an alliance failure. We're softening that. We're entering the world of play and potential state. I'm reminding Donald Winnicott, who said, a therapist who cannot play should not be a therapist.
Wow.
So that's what helps me do that. So once again, I model it. The second thing I do, I try not to want more than them. So what I will do is I'm going to mirror to them very clearly what's going to happen if they don't do it. But then I'm also, and this is another concept, I think it's from Whitaker, detachment from outcome. Like, it's your life. Like Whitaker used to say, I think, I'm taking 100% responsibility over the process. I take zero responsibility over the results. And at moments where I work too hard, and a lot of therapists, we work too hard, we take ownership as if it's our, like we have to prove it. No, it's detachment from outcome. It's their life. You want to stay the emotionally handicapped partner? Fine. But just so you know, this is what might happen. Or for the female partner, right? So you've been a martyr in your mind. You're a martyr for 20 years. That's your right, but you're basically a married single mom. Is that how you want to continue? Because then basically what you're creating is this model that fathers are overrated, and then basically your daughters will be looking for a man just like your husband. Is that what you want? Mm. Like it's very like that, and then they can make a decision. And oftentimes couples they don't want to do a second order change.
So you're saying that what you do in the situation, you know that this stage in life is like crazy and people are so overwhelmed with all kinds of things in life. You said, you know, it's kind of a medium place because they're after the real consumed years.
Right.
They're starting to see the light where they can, not the light, but their selves maybe.
Yeah.
And that's where they start, you know, but when something happens, you're saying, one, I model. I model a way of relationship as a therapist with them, a direct, a talking about my shadows also in some degree, and the ability to be vulnerable. And you're like somehow trying to sell them, if I can say it this way, that maybe it's kedai, you know, it's kedai to try to be this way and to change, because that can give you a lot. That's one, what I'm hearing from you. And the second thing you're saying is that you do show them what will happen if not, if you won't take this opportunity. You're here in therapy. You did do that. Something happened to bring you in here. Now you have the opportunity to do the work that can give you a different quality of life. Do you want it or not? And if not, this will be the outcomes. And so you're bringing all kinds of things, all kinds of ways to make them maybe choose to do the hard work.
I would say I heard somewhere, respect the client, not their business card. I respect that, but not their narrative.
Explain.
And I know that's also kind of a bit weird, but like the idea is I'm trying to confuse them. Confuse them and shake them up. This is real practice with letting go, with detachment from outcome. Like every time I draw, everything I say is subjective. So I'm drawing the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is you get the quiet you wanted. You have less fighting and mediocre sex for the next 40 years. Mm. Cool. And a lot of partners will stop therapy. Actually, I'm okay with that. I rather that than what I don't know. And then as a therapist, I really need to practice detachment often and saying, okay, it's your life. So you won't have a second marriage with your first wife. Like right now with Galit, we're starting our third marriage. Not everybody wants that. And that's legit. And I think again, we can't want it more than our clients. That we always make that mistake. And the second you want it more than your client, you're just going to hit full of resistances. That's not right. That's not precise. No, no, no. And then you just get frustrated. Then you label them as resistant clients. And then you just go into this hole. And maybe I'll just give two quick examples. From two,
we have 10 minutes.
We have 10 minutes. Okay. So should we talk about something else or should I?
If you have examples that are brief, you know, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So I'll give two different examples, two Haredi couples. One, they've been married for 20 years, 9 kids. She now, I mean, he's one of those people that never finished high school. And, you know, he's a dropout. He dropped out of yeshiva and then he basically started a business and he's kind of a businessman and he's done well for himself. And the wife, as now the last stages of doing her master's in Yeutz Chinuchi. Mm-hmm. How do you call that in English?
Educational counseling.
Educational counseling. So she's transitioning into the therapy world and she's like, I want something different. Now, what's interesting about this case is she's completely financially dependent on him, but she wants more from him. And he's like, what do you want? Have been the same. So she's unilaterally changing their contract, demanding a second marriage, but she's not sure, but she doesn't want a divorce. And she's not really sure what she wants. She wants more from me to be more open and more touching and more hugging and more asking, but she's not willing to let go of her martyrhood, of her being alone all these years, suffering, you know, taking a back seat for all his plans because he'd go off for meetings. He'd fly abroad for weeks on end. But then again, that was the original contract. Because when they met, she was 17 or 18 and she had no education and he came to save her. And that's like one example where they're coming because of a rock bottom situation, not because nothing happened. Like there wasn't a major crisis in their marriage. That's why the husband was like, why am I here? He was a visitor. He's like, I really don't know. But she's talking about divorce. I'm like, what? What? And he, by the way, they're still in therapy now. He's still a little bit ambivalent. He's not sure how much he wants to reinvent himself. He's happy with who he is. You know, the emotionally handicapped, working like a dog, you know, wants quiet, maybe more sex from his wife. But like he's more or less content with his first marriage. That's one example. I'll give the opposite example of a different Haredi couple. 5 kids. He's been having affairs for years. Also very successful professionally. And I'm meeting them after 2 or 3 couple of therapies where she's like, I've had it, but she hasn't really had it because she keeps forgiving him and then doing another round and then another round. And every time she ups the guarantees, she wants this and she wants to go to a lawyer and they signed a financial agreement. But it's still the same dance where he's basically, you know, bala me'a u bala de'a. The provider can, you know, he has the control. And she still sees herself, once again, as kind of a victim who's always suffering, but she's not willing. You know, she threatens with divorce, but there's a part of her that's scared. Even though she is working, she's working full time, but she won't be able to maintain the lifestyle she currently has. But she's more focused on him repenting, you know, and guaranteeing that he will never betray her again than actually growing herself. And that's being replicated with me, where I'm being cast either as her savior or as her persecutor. And she keeps wanting me to change her husband, but she's actually does not want to confront herself. And she's scared of actually leaving.
The shadows.
She's not. Yeah. Usually what I'll see is the women, especially women who are finding themselves in the victim/martyr roles, it's very hard for them to own their shadows. Dafka, the men who are labeled as either aggressive or, you know, emotionally handicapped, it's easier for them. Because anyways, they're getting slammed all the week. So it's left of the transition. But if I'm the victim for the past 20 years, so owning my shadow means I have a responsibility. Because in systemic therapy, I like to say, you're never 100% innocent, but you're never 100% guilty. And for a lot of these women or men, owning their shadow means owning responsibility, or in systemic, owning their secondary gains from the current dance. Wow. And that is very hard for a lot of people. But then again, you spritz some play on it and you own some of it yourself and you're modeling it. So it eases. It's like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So spoonful of play lets the interpretation or the reflection go down a little bit smoother for the clients.
Wow. Sounds like such a creative dance as a therapist, you know, to bring, to see it as such a... how do you call it? Like, a creation.
You know, therapy, psychotherapy is not, you know, Freud tried to make it a science. It's not a science, it's an art. It's time to reclaim the art. And I want to,
And
Brad Keeney talks about, he says, once the shaman or the prophet was everything, was an educator, was an artist, was a therapist, it was a person who went through all these processes. And today we've separated therapy, art, and education to different disciplines. They're the same. They all talk about change. And it's time to reclaim, as therapists, to reclaim those different parts of ourselves, to be alive. And also one more thing, because we need to enjoy ourselves, because if not, this is an inhumane profession. We're basically loaded with trauma 5 days a week, 6 days a week, and then we're supposed to live our lives. Now, we have to find the creativity, or else we will burn out, or we will become an imposter syndrome, or we will become a dry, cynical, sarcastic person, which is really sad.
So sorry that we don't have more time, because I feel like, you know, we can talk about this forever. And you're bringing in so many musagim. So many
concepts,
concepts that, you know, imposter syndrome and everything you talked about now could be so interesting to talk about. So I'm sorry we have like a few minutes. Do you want to like say a few things about where can people find you?
And yeah.
Great. Because I'm not sure we're going to have notes to put in. So first of all, I'm going to try to pick a few links also. But
so I'll just say briefly. The website's called Potential State. So it's potentialstate.com, one word. And then there's a YouTube channel called Potential State. You search inside YouTube and there's 112 videos. There's the Potential State podcast, which is the same content but in audio. And then I have a blog on psychology today, which is called The Other Side of Relationships, where I kind of dive deeper into that. So all of those links are in my website called potentialstate.com. And there's also a newsletter, which we send out every 2 weeks with more original videos and content. And obviously you guys can be in touch with me. And I'd be happy to help. And Micha, I want to thank you for this opportunity. And I wish you and all your students Batzlacha. And may we be able to, you know, bring joy and connect people to themselves and to each other.
So first of all, thank you very much to you. I think I learned a lot. And I enjoyed it a lot. I think we had here also a lot of information. I mean, intense information and very exact and very clear. And also lots of playfulness. I mean, I think you modeled it very nicely here, and I enjoyed it very much. I hope.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So thank you very much.
So that was my talk with Dr. Micha Belzer. I hope you found it interesting and engaging as much as we did. And I'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Potential State podcast. For more information, visit us at potentialstate.com. Thanks for listening.